Welcome to episode 83 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and paper making masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Susan Christofferson, who specializes in surface design processes on paper, such as itajime, Japanese fold, clamp, and die, and hand-painted paste papers. She lives and works in Turner Valley, Alberta, Canada, on a hilltop with a view of the foothills and the Rockies, along with her husband and a small farm of chickens and sheep. Christofferson is inspired by the long-distance view from her home and studio, where she creates unique landscape paintings and abstract images using the papers she has made, painted, dyed, and collected during the past 40-plus years. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Susan Christofferson, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you, Helen.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, and I have long admired your decorated papers, and I think we met, 30 years ago or something at Friends of Dart Hunter Paper Conference. That's now the North American Hand Paper Makers.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And then I ended up in Oregon where you were living, and now we're both near the Rocky Mountains in different parts of the world.
I'm just a little bit north of you.
Yeah. In Canada. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to hearing about your journey with paper. So just tell me a little bit about your childhood. You mentioned some interesting art and craft things that you did as a child to me.
I have always been a maker, Helen. Uh-huh. My earliest remembrances were coloring paper, drawing lines around pop tops and little shapes on my Auntie Sue's kitchen table in New Hampshire. Uh-huh. And I'm still coloring in shapes. But that was at the age of 4 or 5.
Right.
And I've always been a maker, always sewing things. My dad was an army engineer. The family traveled to different locations in the world. But he taught me how to work with my hands. We did enamels over a torch. We wove lampshades. We carved figures. We made a train table with all of the mountains and trees and tunnels. And he, at about the age of 6, he gave me a hand crank sewing machine and a piece of paper with a labyrinth or spirals drawn on it. And if I could get the needle holes into the lines, he would give me thread so I could then sew. Mm-hmm. And I've been sewing ever since. As a teenager, I sewed most of my clothes for my younger sister, doll clothes for my troll doll. And as a 6 or 7 year old, my dad gave me a little toolbox that he made, a wooden box with a handle across it. And it had a hammer and a screwdriver and a hand drill or something like that. Making has just always been what I do. And
yeah, it
has been a long journey stepping towards the goal of the way that I work with paper.
Uh-huh. I'm curious about the your father and the sewing machine. Did he sew?
He did. Uh-huh. He learned how to sew because he was reupholstering used furniture for our family to use.
Ah.
He was an army officer.
Yeah.
And I remember being at his shoulder while he was, you know, taking apart cloth or taking apart the upholstery of furniture and using that as a pattern to make new coverings. I also remember going with him to the Army base wood shop and playing with the curls of planed wood.
Oh, yeah.
And as a teenager, he taught me how to use a shopsmith and I was cutting wine bottles to make glasses. And when I had a sculpture class, he made the armature for me out of pipes and always enabling.
Right, right. And were you able to take, where were you in high school? And did you take art, shop, any kind of creative classes?
I did. My 9th and 10th grades were in Alexandria, Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And I did take art class there. And then for grade 11 and 12, I was in Fort Worth, Texas. And I did take art class. And I think I was president of the local of the high school art club. And I was listed as the most likely to succeed in art in my little yearbook.
Right, right. Cool. Okay. And then
I recall that I made a tissue paper globe light fixture around a big beach ball. That's probably my first paper thing.
Uh-huh.
And my dad helped me wire it.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like a rainbow of tissue paper color around a sphere. And I'd also done some textile things.
Right, right. Did the, I'm just curious about the beach ball. Did you deflate it and take it out or did it stay inside?
It was, it had a separator of Vaseline, so mm-hmm. I could deflate it mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and take the ball out.
Right. Neat, neat. Okay. And then I think you ended up going to college in Texas. Is that right?
I did. I went to the University of Texas at Austin mm-hmm. and I got a general BFA.
Okay.
In everything from metalsmithing and ceramics and sculpture and all the required art history, and then quite a number of textile classes.
And did you have any particular path in mind, sort of where you were going?
Well, as I got the BFA, mm-hmm. and then I took an extra year to get teaching credentials.
Okay.
Because I thought, because leaving high school, I felt like my high school art teachers had been the most important people to me.
Uh-huh.
So that was the path I'd like to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I went off to teach high school for a year.
Okay.
In Wichita Falls. And I was very, very interested in textiles. So I was doing batik and stitchery. And I took a weaving class that also included glass blowing. And while I was teaching high school that one year, I did do batik and I took a fiber class workshop from Cynthia Shira, who was then the fibers instructor in Lawrence, Kansas.
Oh.
So it was working with planar papers and making large scale suspended things,
ooh,
forms.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't know much about textiles, so I went off to graduate school to learn about textiles.
Okay, and where did you go to grad school? And
at Indiana University Bloomington.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I had to do a preliminary year for the MFA there because the weaving class I'd taken in college had been independent study. And while I did weave some things, I didn't know a lot about weaving, and there was no surface design. I didn't know silk screening for fabrics. I didn't know how to do gradients of dye work on fabric or yarn. So I did a year of preparatory work, and then it was a 3-year MFA.
Oh, wow. So those were requirements to get into the MFA program.
Yes, it was.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay. And so, when did you start working with paper? Did that start in grad school or?
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm. My first 2 years in the MFA program, I had assistantships in surface design. Mm-hmm. And my mentor was Joan Sterenberg.
Okay.
And she had just started a papermaking studio for the fibers program. And I became the papermaking studio technician.
Oh.
For my third year in my MFA program. And that's where I dove into paper.
Okay. So making it And did you do surface design techniques on it as well?
Yes, I did a lot of pulp painting. And we were making paper out of, you know, various fibers like cattails. And we ordered a crate of artichokes. And so we all ate artichokes and then made artichoke paper. And I was building studio equipment.
Wow.
Like the drying system and dye bags for fibers and all the fiber type experiments that one could do. And the imagery that I was doing in pulp painting was twofold. One was Landsat or space photographs of the Earth, because I'd seen a book of the Landsat spacecraft photographs. And then at that time, I was also studying South American art history. And I was very, very interested in the Nazca earthworks. So I was making things that had lines similar to the earthworks in Chile.
Wow. Okay. And this was when, the late 70s?
Yes. I graduated in the spring of 1980.
Okay. So paper making was fairly new. Do you know where Joan had learned it, or did she just start herself, or just curious?
She just, as far as I know, she just started herself. I've never asked her where she learned that. I guess I should. I know she was friends with the Clarks in Indiana.
From Twin Rocker.
From Twin Rocker. And her MFA was from Berkeley.
Okay.
So she was friends with papermakers in that area.
Right. Because Twin Rocker started, would have just been a few years old at that time. So, yeah, it's interesting to think about the lineage. Cool. Okay. So then what happened after grad school?
Well, I ended up taking a job at Miami University in Ohio, which is north and west of Cincinnati. And I brought my treasure trove of handmade papers with me. And my teaching responsibilities were in constructed textiles, so weaving and knitting and crocheting and basket making and form making. And then surface design, which was all of the dye work and shibori, which I had learned a great deal about in graduate school as well. And then basic design and some MFA students to supervise. So I was full on getting the studios ready for that. And then I wanted paper. So I started making collages, sewing collages with the papers that I brought with me. And there was no paper studio. But there was a paper engineering program on the campus, not far from the art building. And I talked my way into being able to use the basement of the paper engineering building as a papermaking studio. And they had a valley beater that we could use. And over a few years' time, I was able to amass molds and felts. And there was a press that we could use. And so I ended up being able to teach papermaking. And during that time, Tim Barrett came to the university. So I got to know him fairly well. And I was co-director of the art department gallery. And that included some visiting artists. So Winifred Lutz came. And then I was combining shibori techniques with high shrinkage pulps and the forms that using some of the ideas that Winifred had. And at one time there, I also went to visit her in her studios. So I was very, very interested in paper and paper making, and also interested in being able to control the color and the texture of what I was working with. So I still was sewing collages, but I'd run out of my handmade papers, and I was doing a lot of dye work of BFK Reeves and Arsh papers, mm-hmm. as if it was a cotton cloth. So I built 3x4 foot dye vats that were very shallow. Mm-hmm. And I was putting my large pieces of paper in there and then cutting and sewing those into things kind of like quilts, but there was no backing. There was no batting. There was no backing. It wasn't something to put on the bed.
Yeah.
And I was at that time also involved with the Art Quilt Network, which Nancy Crow started mm-hmm. in Eastern Ohio. Mm-hmm. And she's the one who is the big force behind the art quilts that we know today.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So she had a small group that met from time to time and discussed art and quilt and fabric ideas. And at that time, I also was part of called a group called FIGS, Fiber Interest Group in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met Peg Ryan.
Oh, yeah.
And that would happen once a month, and I would drag my students along, and it was people doing elaborate quilts and baskets and paper and all circling around the fibers topic.
Right. And Peg Ryan, for listeners, that's Margaret Ryan, and she's still active. She makes
beautiful
papers with plant. Just
additives.
Yeah. Collaged on and embedded. Yeah. I want to go back just real quick to you mentioned paper engineering, that paper engineering building, and paper engineering today is like folding and this sort of higher math paper. But I think what the paper engineering at the university was, more like
manufactured paper.
Yeah. The study of manufactured paper and people that would go on into that field were studying that.
So they were developing new mixes of paper and learning how to use the paper engineering equipment to produce the masses of paper that we live with.
Right. Right. And that's so interesting that you would think that, I mean, maybe there are small, that paper as art would fits naturally into that kind of department or building. But this is the first time I'm hearing of that. Mm-hmm. And you weren't really part of the program or anything, but you just happened to be able to, use some of their equipment and be in the same space.
Yes, it was an art class that I was, art paper class that I was able to teach.
But did any of those students?
None of the engineering students joined in.
No. Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
I was just able to talk my way into the space.
Right. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay. So, wow. So how long were you in Ohio?
I was there 8 years.
Okay.
And became a tenured associate professor.
Okay. All right. And then what happened? Is that when you went to Oregon somehow?
Yes. I met my husband, uh-huh. Larry Kapuska, who is a scientist mm-hmm. in environmental risk assessment.
Okay.
And botany. And we decided we'd like to live someplace else. Mm-hmm. And we looked for places that we wanted to live. Mm-hmm. And my family moves between New Hampshire and Texas. So that's where I was looking for jobs. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to go where he could hunt and fish. Mm. So he was looking at Maine and Wisconsin and Oregon.
Okay.
And he found a job with the Environmental Protection Agency at their Oregon lab. So we moved there and I took a job in Portland, which is about an hour and a half drive away, as head of the Oregon College of Arts and Crafts fiber program.
Okay, so wait, he was in Corvallis at the university?
No, at the Environmental Protection Agency.
EPA. And where was
EPA?
That? What's an hour and a half away? That's what I'm not.
Portland from Corvallis, where we lived.
Okay.
We bought a home in Corvallis where the lab was.
Okay. So that was.
And then I decided that I needed to continue to work as a teacher, and I applied to Oregon College of Arts and Crafts because they had an opening for someone to lead the fiber arts program.
Right. Okay. And so, what happened there? Did you start papermaking there as part of the fibers?
I did.
Okay.
Initially, I had to get the weaving studio and the surface design studio and the sewing studios in order.
Mm-hmm.
And then was able to sell off a few looms that we didn't need and buy a Raina beater.
Ah, okay.
And gradually, with what budget I had, buy molds and decals and felts and move papermaking forward.
Right. Wow. Okay. And so what year did you start working there? Were you 88 to 91, something like that?
Yes.
Okay. Right. And then I moved to Oregon in 98. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you were the head of the department, and how many, I'm just curious, how were there several faculty teaching in fibers, or?
There were a few.
Mm-hmm.
There was someone who was working on the floor looms, teaching mm-hmm. those, and then someone who was teaching tapestry,
mm-hmm.
and somebody else who was teaching the sewing related things,
mm-hmm.
Who was a specialist in making art garments. And there was somebody who was teaching spinning.
Okay. And what were you teaching?
Well, I ended up teaching a floor loom weaving class and then silk screen for fabric and mm-hmm. shibori. And the way that I was able to challenge myself in teaching was to always teach something that I almost knew everything for, but didn't.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So I set up these deadlines for myself to master the topic or learn more about the topic that I was teaching. So the topics were shifting, never exactly the same.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's sort of move into, I know you do a lot of paste paper and dyeing techniques, etagemé. How did that all come about? I mean,
well,
or evolve. I know you were already doing some of it.
Well, what I just spoke about with shifting the mm-hmm. focus or the topic of a course that I might teach.
Right.
I kept trying to find something and I couldn't find it. Whatever it was I was looking for, it just wasn't coming to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was buying papers from every source that I could, decorative papers.
Mm-hmm.
And still sewing collages.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had been at Miami University, I got a research grant and was able to go with Yoshiko Wada, who is the world shibori expert, on a study tour in Japan. And we did look at textiles and shibori and paper making studios. And so while I was at Oregon College of Arts and Crafts, I was responsible for extension workshops, weekend workshops that the core students could take if they were interested, but that would also attract people from the outside.
Right.
And I set up a series of 5 decorative paper workshops on 5 sequential weekends.
Ah.
So one was on embossed paper,
mm-hmm.
and one was pulp painting, and I taught etagemé for paper. And then Sandy Tilcock from Eugene, who is a bookbinder, mm-hmm. came and taught paste painting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a 2-day workshop. And that was, I felt like I'd finished a 20-year apprenticeship when that paste painting workshop happened, because here was my way of controlling color, texture, pattern, scale, value, hue, anything that I wanted. And it's a very personal gestural technique that's signature-like. And I just fell in love with it. And so that's where the two processes of paste paper and etagemé got pushed forward for me. And I'm also very, very interested in what if, mm-hmm. what if I do X or Y? Mm-hmm. And I knew a lot about dye techniques. I knew a lot about shibori. I knew a lot about pigments. I took painting classes in my undergraduate program. So, you know, what if I did this or that or the other thing? Right. And I began experimenting and testing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I tested different paste ingredients singly and then in pairs and in trios. And you know, what could I do to make something that would work for me right. and that I could also sell? And I wanted to know more. And there was no more to be found. Mm. There was no internet at that time.
Right.
And so I began going to rare book libraries to find examples of decorative papers. And they are usually in books mm-hmm. right. as end sheets. So the University of Oregon was an hour away. I was selling papers to De Medici Ming in Seattle. So uh-huh. when I went there, then I went to the University of Washington Library, where they had Sandra Krupa as mm-hmm. a curator of books or paper. And she is one of the first people to be cataloging the decorative papers in books.
Yes.
So as a piece of the information that goes with the book, she was doing that. So it was possible for her to bring out a whole cart of right. papers. And that wow. started my curiosity. Well, what else is there?
Yeah, no, this is fascinating. I want to get into this. But so at some point you transitioned to becoming more of a full-time artist. Is that right?
That is right. I was at Oregon College of Arts and Crafts for 3 years, which I absolutely loved. Mm-hmm. And I had a sleeping room in Portland and mm-hmm. then would come home. I would work in Portland 3 to 4 days and come home for 3 days. And Larry was traveling a fair amount at that time as well. So sometimes we didn't see each other for a month. And our social life was never, it didn't exist because I was developing relationships in Portland and he was developing relationships in Corvallis. And,
right.
And I got to the point where I was complaining more than being delighted with what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so that was time to stop. And I also wanted to be a mother. And I didn't see that happening living in two places. So we began to pursue adoption and I resigned and Larry had resigned the year before and he started his own business. And after a couple of years, we adopted a child. And so I was doing full-time studio work as much as I could. And I began sessional teaching at Oregon State University and mm-hmm. the university in Monmouth, which was 45 minutes north of us, and also artist in some of the schools.
Okay. And then in terms of your own work, you were making decorative papers and
was working to learn how to make paste paper that met my contemporary needs. Mm-hmm. I learned historic paste paper, which is cooked starch and pigment. But that's mm-hmm. not tough enough for contemporary retail because it's soft and it's reversible and it can crock. Uh-huh. So how could I make paste papers and how could I invent tools? That was so much fun.
Oh, yeah.
Still, yeah. I have easily thousands of tools, rubber stamps and combs, big combs, I mean, uh-huh. wide combs. And,
right.
And just getting the right table and getting flat files. And then with the etagemé.
Now, describe what etagemé is, please. And I remember taking a wonderful workshop with you in Banff, Canada, at a conference where we had all these little folded up bits of paper and we dipped them into. You did so much prep work for that. I was really impressed.
I always do that, Helen.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So etagemé is a kind of tie-dye.
It's fold and dye. Fold, clamp, and dye tie-dye. Mm-hmm. So it is one of the tie-dye or one of the shibori techniques, shibori being the Japanese tie-dye.
Okay.
And I had to learn what papers would work.
Right. Yeah.
And what colorants would work.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, three things that made them much better from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
One was that I could use light, fast, wash, fast calligraphy inks and not have to do the dye process with chemicals that then needed to be washed out. The second thing was a lightning bolt that happened in the middle of the night. One night when I remembered working with two Chinese painters at Miami University who were there as art in residence, and I was responsible for helping them set up their studio. And while doing that, they, for a whole week, we went back and forth. They wanted some ul for the studio, and I had no idea what ul was.
Uh-huh.
And I'd given them Tupperware to mix their paints in and gotten easels and tables. And they finally said, oh, you know, the stuff you make paper on, ul. They wanted to put wool, felt, underneath their absorbent paper, their waterleaf paper, so they could do their ink painting and not have the ink pool under the paper.
Oh, and spread around on the back.
Spread around. Well, it would absorb back in.
Right.
Because
right.
they were working with a waterleaf paper.
So it would go into the felt. Uh-huh.
So I started using army blankets on my large tables.
Uh-huh.
Because I have to open the paper immediately. And that then lets the color stay in the paper, because the fibrils or little fibers of the wool sticking up let the paper float above the wool cloth.
Right.
So that was number two. And number three that I figured out is that if I used isopropyl alcohol with, subsequently with dipping into the light, fast, wash, fast inks, I could get what I call tide lines, more delicate patterning. And so I finally had something that other people could use that wasn't going to run and fade.
Yeah. And would work on paper.
And would work on paper. Right. Absolutely.
Right.
Because I had done a lot of work with shibori on cloth.
Yeah.
And that's just different.
Yeah. Right. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah.
So I guess what I would say is that during that time, between 91 and 2005, when we moved to Canada, I was researching the what if question. What if I do this? What if I do that? What if I use, you know, little plexiglass pieces on either side of my folded paper? What if I use chopsticks? What if I use washers? What if I whatever? And anytime I had a chance to travel, I was pursuing paste papers. And my route would divert to a rare book paper collection or a paste paper book collection in a library somewhere.
Right. So tell me about one highlight, a visit that you made.
Oh, there are many.
well, pick one.
Larry had to go to Berlin for a conference. And so I went along. I jumped on a train from Berlin and went to Herrnhut, which is a town in southeastern Germany, almost in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a place where in the 1600s, Count Zinzendorf invited Moravian Protestants to come and live on his property so they wouldn't be prosecuted.
Mm.
And this is where the first group of identifiable paste paper artists did elaborate and innovative paste painting.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to take a train there, get on the right bus, get to the town with an appointment ahead of time, and look at the archive there, which was just thrilling.
Right. Were you looking at end sheets or actual sheets of paper or both?
There were no actual sheets of loose paper.
Mm-hmm.
They were all end sheets in books or covers on pamphlets.
Mm.
And I've been able to photograph every place that I went because I promised I wouldn't be publishing. I could use them for teaching, but I wouldn't publishing.
Wow, that's cool. And I know you've seen many others.
So I have hundreds and hundreds of images of paste papers from around the world. Mm-hmm. It's exciting to me to identify a friend paste paper artist who lived 400 years ago, because I know their hand. I know their mark making. I know their aesthetic. And that just rings my bell.
Oh, yeah, I can relate. Not in paste paper, but yeah, just seeing something and being like, I know how that was done, or recognizing mm-hmm. you've seen their particular paper in another book elsewhere. Right. Fantastic.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about the Paper Advisor, a place where you can discover my most popular papermaking and papercraft resources, including information about tools and supplies, how-to videos, and paper tips, all in one place. You can ask the Paper Advisor your paper questions there, too. And best of all, it's free. Find the Paper Advisor by going to HelenHebertStudio.com and looking for the free Paper Advisor link in the upper right-hand corner. Now back to the episode.
Fast forwarding, you're in Canada now. What brought you there, and how has your art practice changed?
We needed a steady job between the two of us.
Uh-huh.
And Larry ended up being offered a job in Calgary.
Okay.
And this is when the Republican administration had been taking apart the environmental regulations in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So his work dried up, and I could only get sessional work.
Ah.
And we just couldn't afford to stay in the U.S. any longer. And he was offered a job and a salary and moving expenses.
Oh, wow.
At no direct cost
right.
to us.
Right.
So I didn't want to move, but we needed to.
Yeah.
And that's when I was in Banff and you took that workshop from me, our moving van was on the road.
So when was that? 2005. Okay.
And Brian Queen lives here in Calgary. And so I reached out to him to begin to make friends with common right. interests.
Right. Yeah. And so you sent me some pictures of you and your studio. Is that in your home? You have a fairly large studio?
I have a fairly large studio, and it is adjacent to my home.
Okay.
The property that we have is 10 and a half acres on a hilltop. Mm-hmm. And the studio is what used to be a llama barn and half of the hay barn. So it was filled with hay and manure and sawdust when we got here. And it took, as always, time to renovate the space and finally get it plumbed. And so it's just the walk across the parking pad. And I share the wall with the chicken coop and sheep.
Ah, okay. But your walls are all white and it looks very clean. And it's no longer a barn. Yeah.
It's insulated. You know, Larry, we found that the floor was supported by manure, so that got taken apart and rebuilt. And I put a paper surface on the floor.
Oh, wow. That's like a Korean tradition, right?
Yeah. There was an art supply store in Cincinnati that had paper on the floor.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. Uh-huh. And I mentioned to you in writing before our discussion today that I have a roll of denim paper from Crane & Company.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. It came to me as 4 miles long. And so that's what
wide was the roll? How wide is 4 miles?
11 inches.
Just 11 inches. Okay.
I imagined it was going to be 21 inches or 23 inches, and it wasn't. It was meant for stationery.
Okay, so what did you do to that paper to put it on the floor? Did you decorate it?
I crumpled it up and wet it and then smoothed it out and used, I used polymer medium to glue it to the floor and then put a couple layers of floor varnish on it.
So does it have the crumple texture?
Slightly.
Okay. I mean, I know it needs to be flat. What was the crumpling for? Just
That was to modify the shrinkage and the swelling and the shrinkage because I dampened the papers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, cool. Cool. Okay. So what are you doing these days with your art? I see you're still making collages, but I think they're a little different than before. Are that you still stitching or are they more traditional collages?
Present, I have not been stitching. There was a period of time in Calgary and part of the time here in Turner Valley when I was doing collaborative work with Ken Froese, who is a scientist, but also a photographer, landscape photographer. Mm-hmm. And so I was collaging into his photographs and drawing with thread. So stitching or embroidering into the photographs. And I have not done much sewing of paper collages lately. Mm-hmm. They've been glued, but I still do a lot of sewing. So the collages, for the most part, are inspired by the long distance view we have here of the foothills and the Front Range of the Rockies, and the way the light falls on the land through the clouds. Mm-hmm. The seasons change. It's just magical all the time. It's so inspirational the way a field will light up, or the trees suddenly are yellow, or the colors of the sunrise, or the colors of the sunset, or the colors of the smoke and the fires from British Columbia. It inspires me.
Yeah. Yeah. Your collages, recent collages, are beautiful, and I'll post pictures. And do you photograph, or do you just work live or from memory?
I do take photographs, snapshots, mostly with my phone, of unique moments. Mm-hmm. But I seldom work from the photograph. I might go back to it and be slightly reminded.
Right.
But the photographs that I sent you, was it in the middle of the night last night? are in response to a particular morning sky that I saw, and I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm in the area of Big Alberta sky, big sky. Right. And one particular morning recently, the sky was turquoise and the clouds were salmon. Mm. And so that orange blue combination was keying off each other, making one another seem more turquoise and more salmon. And I've got to do some more dye work and some paste painting because I don't have the right shade of paste paper to make the sky.
Right.
And I don't have the right dyed lace paper to make the clouds. Mm-hmm. So I have some work to do. And until I satisfy that urge, that's my goal.
Right. So you're kind of working back and forth. I know you have a large paper stash that you can grab from, but then you're also making new papers too.
I'm painting new papers.
Painting new papers. Right.
And I have lots of molds and paper making teaching equipment in our garage. And I occasionally use that for teaching, but I'm not making paper.
Right.
At this time, I love making paper, but it's the same as deciding you're not going to raise sheep, to shear the wool, to spin the yarn, to weave the cloth, because what you really want to make is garments.
Right. Yeah, it's very hard to do it all. I get that.
It is impossible to do it all. And and I, as I said, I love making paper, but by making paper, I understand the characteristics of the papers that I need to use.
Right. Love that. And so where are you exhibiting your work and selling your papers?
I am exhibiting work at galleries in Alberta. Mm-hmm. I work with the Alberta Craft Council, and they have a gallery in Edmonton and also one in Calgary. And right now I have a large collage, 2 feet high and 12 feet wide. It's a triptych of the landscape that I see that's at the Alberta Craft Council C-Space Gallery. Mm-hmm. C-Space is a retrofit school as an incubator type space. Mm-hmm. I have work with Collectors Gallery in Calgary and with Willick and Sachs Gallery in Banff and with Blue Rock Gallery in my neighboring town, Black Diamond. And outside of that, I occasionally have pieces in shows. I was in the Paper Feast show last year or 2 years ago in Shanghai.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm losing track of time here, but was it last year that I had paper accepted? 2 years ago, paper accepted into the Paper Legacies collection at the Metropolitan Art Museum.
Oh, yeah, that's a great collection of many artists, and we'll definitely link to that in the show notes. Yeah, and you, some
so
images
selling
of your
papers. Yeah. I sell papers directly to people through my website, and I sell papers at conferences or meetings that I go to, and I sell collage packs. I happen to have lots of offcuts, so I put those together once or twice a year, and I sell those in some local art supply stores, but they're certainly available elsewhere. And from time to time, if I am going to Texas to be with family, I usually have an appointment with Paper Arts in Dallas, Texas. And I have sold papers to De Medici Ming that was in Seattle. They're now on one of the islands.
Okay.
Off
they're still
the coast
around.
Of Washington. It's still there.
Yeah.
I haven't sold to them lately, but.
Right. And on your website, which is Christofferson with an F-studio.ca, listeners, you can look and see the range of paste papers that Susan makes. And do you have a Taj Ahmed also?
Yes.
Yeah. And you can order. It's not like a store. It's more of a custom thing. Is that right?
It is pretty custom.
Yeah.
People say I'm interested in wavy blue with stars. And so I find if I've got that or make a small sample and we send some snapshots back and forth then I create what they need.
Right. I'm curious about what your day looks like. Do you have a sort of a routine, including like feeding animals and whatnot?
Well, my animal routine usually is washing and selling eggs.
Okay.
And I only do the feeding of animals when Larry's away.
Okay.
I am usually awake really early, and I am quiet and still for 2 or 3 hours watching the landscape. I had been on a trip in Scotland and ended up in Banff, Scotland, where I met with Alison Simpson, who I'd met at one of the Friends of Dart Hunter meetings. And she was at that moment in charge of an art festival that happened the next day. And I met a sculptor that she'd invited from the Shetland Islands. And one of the things he said was that his sculpture was just amazing to me. He makes it from things that drift up on the shore of the Shetland Islands.
Ah.
And he said that he sits for 2 or 3 hours and watches the light rise. And at that point, I felt I was living a life that wasn't right for me. And that's what eventually prompted us to move out of the city of Calgary to this location.
Okay.
So my routine in the day, it's extremely varied. Sometimes if I've got a deadline, there's a craft show coming up or an open studio coming up, then I'm hot on the studio work. Mm-hmm. In the summer, all I want to do is garden.
Mm-hmm.
My work schedule is extremely varied, but I get a lot of work done. So it's different every day. So cool. I don't know if I've answered the question about a schedule. With COVID, I've just been here a lot.
Right.
Working in production because we're old enough and have enough issues that it just made no sense to be out and about.
Right. Right. I wanted to just touch on the other things you make with your papers because you do make a few other products. Tell me about those.
Well, there are times of the year, one of them which is approaching now, when I'm not in the garden and we've had snow already. But I just feel like making things. So every year I learn a new origami ornament form. And then I spend a couple weeks just folding units and putting those together. Or I sell in some craft fairs and some art shops that have handcrafted items. So I was awake last night and I spent a couple hours working on bookmarks that are little bits of paste paper with ribbons threaded through them.
Right.
I do some bookbinding, but I have no patience for high quality professional bookbinding. When I do bookbinding, it's often learning a new technique and then putting that into production or making note cards and figuring out how to do that in production. So it's not a one-off. It's, you know, I'm making 200 cards or stick books and also upcycled things. I'm an inveterate perpetual thrift store person. And so I made a set of books that were made with oversized playing card covers. So that the playing card was folded in half and then I could do a little stitch to put one signature into it. And the papers are the blue jean paper that I got from Crane and Company. Last winter, I made hundreds and hundreds of paper beads, partly because I was wanting to sell my paper origami ornaments through the Craft Council. And the ornaments, some of them needed to be cinched together. So I needed something to cinch them with. And I put glass beads at the bottom. And then a thread and a loop to hang your ornament. But the Craft Council would not accept those offshore made beads because they have artists, glass artists who make glass beads. So I had to think of something else to use and it took me a few weeks, but it dawned on me I can make paper beads. So then I started making paper beads and figuring out how to make the beads in production and developing tools for making beads. And then, I can make necklaces. Well, again, the Craft Council doesn't want offshore made glass beads. So then I went to semi-precious stones. So then I have to find all the sources of semi-precious stones that are interesting to me that work with paste paper or tajame paper. And I'm very intrigued with how the paper transforms once it becomes three-dimensional. So then all of that went into production.
Wow. It's a paper journey. Okay. I wanted to get to your recommendations. You had a couple of books you wanted to recommend and then maybe a couple of papers, like a favorite paper for paste paper and etajame.
Okay, I'll do that. And I also thought of two artists I might suggest. So I'll start out with Karen McCarthy, and I'll send you her website. She's an artist in the Boston area that I've visited every time I've gone to a family summer property in New Hampshire. And she is the most inventive decorative paper artist I have known. And I've been meeting with her for almost 25 years, and she makes paper collages and surface design papers. And this a couple several weeks ago when I was in New Hampshire, or in the summer, late summer, mm-hmm. I met with her and she was making papers with, or using pages like National Geographic pages, putting a embroidered textile under it, commercially embroidered patterned textile under it, mm-hmm. and using sandpaper and steel wool to remove some of the ink from the paper, making really interesting paper, but also doing paper and surface design things. And
wow,
she's quite wonderful.
Okay. Yeah. I look forward to looking at her work and sharing it with readers.
And then another artist, paper artist that I came across was at the New Hampshire League of Craftsmen show this summer in New Hampshire. Her name is Lauren Polaro. Mm-hmm. And I'll send you her information. She's in York, Maine, okay. making really cool paper earrings and paper collages.
Oh, wonderful.
With a graphics and painting background.
Mm-hmm.
So then in terms of books, there's a book called A Year of Painting by Matthew Langley.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a collection of a year's worth an everyday painting, a painting every day that is quite small, like 6 by 4 inches or 6 by 7 inches. And it's stripes. That's all.
Uh-huh.
And it looks as if some tape was used, some skinny tapes and some fatter tapes and a layer of color put down and dried and then tape and another layer of color put down. So it's just colors and stripes. But I find that really fascinating.
Yeah.
And then another book that I came across that was really inspirational to me is called Chromatopia, an Illustrated History of Color by David Coles, mm-hmm. published by Thames and Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes pigment by pigment. And David Coles has spent his lifetime learning about and making pigment.
Wow.
And there were bits of history I didn't know.
Yeah.
It just excites me to learn those details. And you asked about papers. So a lot of the Itajime paper that I have used is the Sumi art paper that Yasutomo and company sell.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite delicate for doing the Itajime. And it's not the highest quality of paper, but it's more affordable than many handmade papers. And it often is available with some kozo in it, which helps with the wet strength.
Right.
An inexpensive or a less expensive paper is paper for dyeing. That's the name of it that Washi Papers offers.
Oh, yeah.
And Washi Papers... is it Blair, Washington State?
It's Bellingham and it's Washi Arts. Yeah.
Washi Arts. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Washi Arts offers many exquisite papers for Itajime in rolls as well as single sheets.
Oh, good.
In terms of paper for paste painting,
mm-hmm.
right now I'm using Mohawk Superfine Text.
Mm-hmm.
Text weight paper, which is archival. It's a book page paper.
Right.
And I buy it in large quantities, like a ream in parent sheets. And then that lasts me a long time.
Right.
And I also have other commercial printers papers that I have gone to a wholesaler like Unisource. And mm-hmm. with an appointment can go in and look at their remainders because it just costs me less.
Right.
And I can get colored papers and textured papers. And I guess it was Peggy Skycraft who led me to that source. And when I buy, 500 or 1,000 sheets of paper, it lasts me a long time.
Right. Is Unisource, is that in Oregon then? I know Peggy's in Oregon. Or do they
have
different?
It is in Oregon, but it's a continent-wide paper supplier for commercial printers.
Okay.
So it's not an art paper,
right?
But I know papers that other artists are using, that Claire Mazurchek uses either Arsh or Reeves. Galen Berry was using paper, commercial paper that's used for popcorn bags.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really lovely feeling paper, and his acrylic marbling works beautifully on it.
Right. I wonder how he stumbled on that. That's interesting.
Well, it's got good wet strength.
Right, right. Have you done any of these techniques on handmade papers?
Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. I certainly have. And many handmade papers are unsized.
Right.
So what one would do is to size the paper prior to working. So what I mean by that is you could have colorless paste and paint that onto the sheet, which then fills up the sheet, and then do your work on top of that.
Right.
Wet or dry.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. And traditional sizing was gelatin. But yeah, I love that idea that you could make any kind of paste.
So it could be your any cooked starch or cooked starch with polymer medium in it to fill up, to size that sheet of paper. And handmade paper generally works very well because it has good wet strength, because the paper maker has been able to handle it in a sodden or a pressed damp form.
Right, right.
And I work all my papers wet. I draw them through a tray of water and then lay them out on a glass top and squeegee off the extra water and begin to work.
Right. Yeah. Well, wonderful.
One of the interesting things that I learned with Martha Cole, who is a surface design paper book artist from Saskatchewan. She came for a master class with me one weekend. And she wanted to figure out how to make two-sided paper covers.
Oh,
And we found out that visqueen, that like 5 mil plastic that is used in construction, can be, so if you use that as a table covering and you paste paint, it can stick to the visqueen while it's wet, but you can peel it off. And then you, once it's just dry, you can flip it over and paint the reverse side.
Oh.
Again, using the visqueen as a table surface cover.
Right. Cool. Always inventing. I love it.
Well, there is so much to
to
consider, and little problem solving just fascinates me and intrigues me and keeps me going forward.
Right. So, yeah, I'm curious about the visqueen and what why you couldn't just put it on a table surface. Is this because some of the color would slip around underneath, or
it would get stuck?
Oh, you wouldn't be able to get it off.
You couldn't get it off the table, because at least the recipe that I use uses a lot of polymer medium.
Right.
So that it's a non-reversible paste surface. Golden acrylic and polymer medium and cooked starch. A mixture for me of five starches.
Right. Right.
And it would stick, and you also want to be able to lift it off the table to move it somewhere to dry so you can keep working.
Right.
And other kinds of plastic, it just seems to stick to, and then you can't get it off at all. And she wanted to be able to have two good sides.
Right. Got it. Well, Susan, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I look forward to seeing what you're up to next.
Who knows? Thanks so much, Helen.
Hey, paper friends, did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
There is a reason besides the season, the main contender.